Dune, Cassette 2.
Yui, Wellington. Standard 10,082 to 10,191. Medical doctor of the Souk School. Graduated standard 10,112. Married Wana Marcus, Bene Gesserit. Standard 10,092 to 10,186. Chiefly noted as betrayer of Duke Leto Atreides. See also Bibliography, Appendix 7, The Imperial Conditioning and Betrayal. From Dictionary of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Although he heard Dr. Yui enter the training room, noting the stiff deliberation of the man's pace, Paul remained stretched out face down on the exercise table where the masseuse had left him. He felt deliciously relaxed after the workout with Gurney Halleck.
"You do look comfortable," said Yui in his calm, high-pitched voice.
Paul raised his head, saw the man's stick figure standing several paces away, took in at a glance the wrinkled black clothing, the square block of a head with purple lips and drooping moustache, the diamond tattoo of imperial conditioning on his forehead, the long black hair caught in the Souk School's silver ring at the left shoulder.
"You'll be happy to hear we haven't time for regular lessons today," Yui said. "Your father will be along presently."
Paul sat up. "However, I've arranged for you to have a film book viewer and several lessons during the crossing to Arrakis."
"Oh."
Paul began pulling on his clothes. He felt excitement that his father would be coming. They had spent so little time together since the Emperor's command to take over the fief of Arrakis. Yui crossed to the L table, thinking, "How the boy has filled out these past few months. Such a waste. Oh, such a sad waste." And he reminded himself, "I must not falter. What I do is done to be certain my Wana no longer can be hurt by the Harkonnen beasts." Paul joined him at the table, buttoning his jacket.
"What'll I be studying on the way across?"
"Ah, the tyrannic life forms of Arrakis. The planet seems to have opened its arms to certain tyrannic life forms. It's not clear how. I must seek out the planetary ecologist when we arrive, a Dr. Kynes, and offer my help in the investigation."
And Yui thought, "What am I saying? I play the hypocrite even with myself."
"Will there be something on the Fremen?" Paul asked.
"The Fremen?"
Yui drummed his fingers on the table, caught Paul staring at the nervous motion, withdrew his hand.
"Maybe you have something on the whole Arrakeen population," Paul said.
"Yes, to be sure," Yui said. "There are two general separations of the people. Fremen, they are one group, and the others are the people of the Graben, the Sink, and the Pan. There's some intermarriage, I'm told. The women of Pan and Sink villages prefer Fremen husbands. Their men prefer Fremen wives. They have a saying, 'Polish comes from the cities, wisdom from the desert.' Do you have pictures of them?"
"I'll see what I can get you. The most interesting feature, of course, is their eyes, totally blue. No whites in them."
"Mutation?"
"No, it's linked to saturation of the blood with melange."
"The Fremen must be brave to live at the edge of that desert."
"By all accounts," Yui said, "they compose poems to their knives. Their women are as fierce as the men. Even Fremen children are violent and dangerous. You'll not be permitted to mingle with them, I dare say."
Paul stared at Yui, finding in these few glimpses of the Fremen a power of words that caught his entire attention. What a people to win as allies.
"And the worms?" Paul asked.
"What?"
"I'd like to study more about the sandworms."
"Ah, to be sure. I've a film book on a small specimen, only 110 meters long and 22 meters in diameter. It was taken in the northern latitudes. Worms of more than 400 meters in length have been recorded by reliable witnesses. And there's reason to believe even larger ones exist."
Paul glanced down at a conical projection chart of the northern Arrakeen latitudes spread on the table.
The desert belt and south polar regions are marked uninhabitable. Is it the worms? And the storms? But any place can be made habitable. If it's economically feasible, Yui said. Arrakis has many costly perils. He smoothed his drooping mustache. Your father will be here soon. Before I go, I've a gift for you, something I came across in packing. He put an object on the table between them, black, oblong, no larger than the end of Paul's thumb. Paul looked at it. Yui noted how the boy didn't reach for it and thought, how cautious he is. It's a very old orange Catholic Bible made for space travelers. Not a film book, but actually printed on filament paper. It has its own magnifier and electrostatic charge system. He picked it up, demonstrated. The book is held closed by the charge, which forces against spring-locked covers. You press the edge, thus, and the pages you've selected repel each other, and the book opens. It's so small. But it has 1,800 pages. You press the edge, thus, and so, and the charge moves ahead one page at a time as you read. Never touch the actual pages with your fingers. The filament tissue is too delicate. He closed the book, handed it to Paul. Try it. Yui watched Paul work the page adjustment, thought, I salve my own conscience. I give him the surcease of religion before betraying him. Thus may I say to myself that he has gone where I cannot go. This must have been made before film books, Paul said. It's quite old. Let it be our secret, eh? Your parents might think it too valuable for one so young. And Yui thought, his mother would surely wonder at my motives. Well, Paul closed the book, held it in his hand. If it's so valuable, indulge an old man's whim, Yui said. It was given to me when I was very young. And he thought, I must catch his mind as well as his cupidity. Open it to 467 Kalima, where it says, From water does all life begin. There's a slight notch at the edge of the cover to mark the place. Paul felt the cover, detected two notches, one shallower than the other. He pressed the shallower one, and the book spread open on his palm, its magnifier sliding into place. Read it aloud, Yui said. Paul wet his lips with his tongue, read, Think you of the fact that a deaf person cannot hear? Then what deafness may we not all possess? What senses do we lack that we cannot see and cannot hear another world all around us? What is there around us that we cannot... Stop it! Yui barked. Paul broke off, stared at him. Yui closed his eyes, fought to regain composure. What perversity caused the book to open at my Wana's favorite passage? He opened his eyes, saw Paul staring at him. Is something wrong? Paul asked. I'm sorry, Yui said. That was my dead wife's favorite passage. It's not the one I intended you to read. It brings up memories that are painful. There are two notches, Paul said. Of course, Yui thought. Wana marked her passage. His fingers are more sensitive than mine and found her mark. It was an accident, no more. You may find the book interesting, Yui said. It has much historical truth in it as well as good ethical philosophy. Paul looked down at the tiny book in his palm. Such a small thing, yet it contained a mystery. Something had happened while he read from it. He had felt something stir his terrible purpose. Your father will be here any minute, Yui said. Put the book away, and read it at your leisure. Paul touched the edge of it as Yui had shown him. The book sealed itself. He slipped it into his tunic. For a moment there, when Yui had barked at him, Paul had feared the man would demand the book's return. I thank you for the gift, Dr. Yui, Paul said, speaking formally. It will be our secret. If there is a gift, a favor you wish from me, please do not hesitate to ask. I need for nothing, Yui said, and he thought, why do I stand here torturing myself, and torturing this poor lad, though he doesn't know it?
Oh, damn those Harkonnen beasts. Why did they choose me for their abomination?
How do we approach the study of Muad'Dib's father? A man of surpassing warmth and surprising coldness was the Duke Leto Atreides. Yet many facts open the way to this duke. His abiding love for his Bene Gesserit lady, the dreams he held for his son, the devotion with which men served him. You see him there, a man snared by destiny, a lonely figure with his light dimmed behind the glory of his son. Still, one must ask, what is the son but an extension of the father? From Muad'Dib, Family Commentaries, by the Princess Irulan.
Paul watched his father enter the training room, saw the guards take up stations outside. One of them closed the door. As always, Paul experienced a sense of presence in his father, someone totally here. The Duke was tall, olive-skinned. His thin face held harsh angles, warmed only by deep gray eyes. He wore a black working uniform with red armorial hawk crest at the breast. A silvered shield belt with the patina of much use girded his narrow waist. The Duke said, "Hard at work, son?" He crossed to the L table, glanced at the papers on it, swept his gaze around the room and back to Paul. He felt tired, filled with the ache of not showing his fatigue. "I must use every opportunity to rest during the crossing to Arrakis," he thought. "There'll be no rest on Arrakis." "Not very hard," Paul said. "Everything so..." He shrugged. "Yes, well, tomorrow we leave. It'll be good to get settled in our new home, put all this upset behind." Paul nodded, suddenly overcome by memory of the Reverend Mother's words, "For the father, nothing." "Father," Paul said, "will Arrakis be as dangerous as everyone says?" The Duke forced himself to the casual gesture, sat down on a corner of the table, smiled. A whole pattern of conversation welled up in his mind, the kind of thing he might use to dispel the vapors in his men before a battle. The pattern froze before it could be vocalized, confronted by the single thought, "This is my son." "It'll be dangerous," he admitted. "Hawat tells me we have a plan for the Fremen," Paul said, and he wondered, "Why don't I tell him what that old woman said? How did she seal my tongue?" The Duke noted his son's distress, said, "As always, Hawat sees the main chance, but there's much more. I see also the Combine Honet Ober Advancer Mercantiles, the Chom Company. By giving me Arrakis, His Majesty is forced to give us a Chom directorship. A subtle gain." "Chom controls the spice," Paul said. "And Arrakis with its spice is our avenue into Chom," the Duke said. "There's more to Chom than melange." "Did the Reverend Mother warn you?" Paul blurted. He clenched his fists, feeling his palms slippery with perspiration. The effort it had taken to ask that question. "Hawat tells me she frightened you with warnings about Arrakis," the Duke said. "Don't let a woman's fears cloud your mind. No woman wants her loved ones endangered. The hand behind those warnings was your mother's. Take this as a sign of her love for us." "Does she know about the Fremen?" "Yes, and about much more." "What?" And the Duke thought, the truth could be worse than he imagines. But even dangerous facts are valuable if you've been trained to deal with them. "And there's one place where nothing has been spared for my son, dealing with dangerous facts. This must be leavened, though he is young." "Few products escape the Chom touch," the Duke said. "Logs, donkeys, horses, cows, lumber, dung, sharks, whale fur, the most prosaic and the most exotic. Even our poor pundi rice from Caladan. Anything the guild will transport
the art forms of Ikaz, the machines of Riches and Ix. But all fades before mélange. A handful of spice will buy a home on Tupile. It cannot be manufactured. It must be mined on Arrakis. It is unique, and it has true geriatric properties. And now we control it? To a certain degree. But the important thing is to consider all the houses that depend on Chom profits. And think of the enormous proportion of those profits dependent upon a single product, the spice. Imagine what would happen if something should reduce spice production. Whoever had stockpiled mélange could make a killing, Paul said. Others would be out in the cold. The Duke permitted himself a moment of grim satisfaction, looking at his son and thinking how penetrating, how truly educated that observation had been. He nodded. The Harkonnens have been stockpiling for more than 20 years. They mean spice production to fail and you to be blamed. They wish the Atreides' name to become unpopular, the Duke said. Think of the Lancerad houses that look to me for a certain amount of leadership, their unofficial spokesman. Think how they'd react if I were responsible for a serious reduction in their income. After all, one's own profits come first. The great convention be damned. You can't let someone pauperize you. A harsh smile twisted the Duke's mouth. They'd look the other way no matter what was done to me. Even if we were attacked with atomics? Nothing that flagrant. No open defiance of the convention, but almost anything else short of that. Perhaps even dusting and a bit of soil poisoning. Then why are we walking into this? Paul, the Duke frowned at his son. Knowing where the trap is, that's the first step in evading it. This is like single combat, son, only on a larger scale. A feint within a feint within a feint. Seemingly without end. The task is to unravel it. Knowing that the Harkonnens stockpile mélange, we ask another question. Who else is stockpiling? That's the list of our enemies. Who? Certain houses we knew were unfriendly, and some we'd thought friendly. We need not consider them for the moment, because there is one other much more important. Our beloved Padishah Emperor. Paul tried to swallow in a throat suddenly dry. Couldn't you convene the Lancerad, expose, make our enemy aware we know which hand holds the knife? Ah, now, Paul, we see the knife now. Who knows where it might be shifted next? If we put this before the Lancerad, it'd only create a great cloud of confusion. The Emperor would deny it. Who could gainsay him? All we'd gain is little time while risking chaos. And where would the next attack come from? All the houses might start stockpiling spice. Our enemies have a head start, too much of a lead to overcome. The Emperor, Paul said. That means the Sardaukar. Disguised in Harkonnen livery, no doubt, the Duke said. But the soldier fanatics, nonetheless. How can Fremen help us against Sardaukar? Did Hawat talk to you about Seleucus Secundus? The Emperor's prison planet? No. What if it were more than a prison planet, Paul? There's a question you never hear asked about the Imperial Corps of Sardaukar. Where do they come from? From the prison planet? They come from somewhere. But the supporting levies the Emperor demands from... That's what we're led to believe. They're just the Emperor's levies, trained young and superbly. You hear an occasional muttering about the Emperor's training cadres, but the balance of our civilization remains the same. The military forces of the Lancerad great houses on one side, the Sardaukar and their supporting levies on the other. And their supporting levies, Paul. The Sardaukar remain the Sardaukar. But every report on Seleucus Secundus says SS is a hell world. Undoubtedly. But if you were going to raise tough, strong, ferocious men, what environmental conditions would you impose on them? How could you win the loyalty of such men? There are proven ways. Play on the certain knowledge of their superiority, the mystique of secret covenant, the esprit of shared suffering. It can be done. It has been done on many worlds in many times. Paul nodded, holding his attention on his father's face.
He felt some revelation impending. "Consider Arrakis," the Duke said, "when you get outside the towns and garrison villages. It's every bit as terrible a place as Seleucus Secundus." Paul's eyes went wide. "The Fremen. We have there the potential of a core as strong and deadly as the Sardaukar. It'll require patience to exploit them secretly and wealth to equip them properly, but the Fremen are there. And the spice wealth is there. You see now why we walk into Arrakis, knowing the trap is there. Don't the Harkonnens know about the Fremen? The Harkonnens sneered at the Fremen, hunted them for sport, never even bothered trying to count them. We know the Harkonnen policy with planetary populations. Spend as little as possible to maintain them." The metallic threads in the hawk symbol above his father's breast glistened as the Duke shifted his position. "You see? We're negotiating with the Fremen right now," Paul said. "I sent a mission headed by Duncan Idaho," the Duke said. "A proud and ruthless man, Duncan, but fond of the truth. I think the Fremen will admire him. If we're lucky, they may judge us by him, Duncan the Moral."
"Duncan the Moral," Paul said, "and Gurney the Valorous."
"You name them well," the Duke said. And Paul thought, "Gurney's one of those the Reverend Mother meant, a supporter of worlds.
The valor of the brave."
"Gurney tells me you did well in weapons today," the Duke said. "That isn't what he told me." The Duke laughed aloud. "I figured Gurney to be sparse with his praise. He says you have a nicety of awareness, in his own words, of the difference between a blade's edge and its tip."
"Gurney says there's no artistry in killing with the tip, that it should be done with the edge."
"Gurney's a romantic," the Duke growled. This talk of killing suddenly disturbed him, coming from his son. "I'd sooner you never had to kill. But if the need arises, you do it however you can, tip or edge." He looked up at the skylight on which the rain was drumming. Seeing the direction of his father's stare, Paul thought of the wet skies out there, a thing never to be seen on Arrakis from all accounts, and this thought of skies put him in mind of the space beyond. "Are the guild ships really big?" he asked. The Duke looked at him. "This will be your first time off-planet," he said. "Yes, they're big. We'll be riding a hayliner because it's a long trip. A hayliner is truly big. Its hold will tuck all our frigates and transports into a little corner. We'll be just a small part of the ship's manifest."
"And we won't be able to leave our frigates?"
"That's part of the price you pay for guild security. There could be Harkonnen ships right alongside us, and we'd have nothing to fear from them. The Harkonnens know better than to endanger their shipping privileges."
"I'm going to watch our screens and try to see a guildsman."
"You won't. Not even their agents ever see a guildsman. The guild's as jealous of its privacy as it is of its monopoly. Don't do anything to endanger our shipping privileges, Paul."
"Do you think they hide because they've mutated and don't look human anymore?"
"Who knows?" The Duke shrugged. "It's a mystery we're not likely to solve. We've more immediate problems. Among them, you."
"Me?"
"Your mother wanted me to be the one to tell you, son. You see, you may have Mentat capabilities."
Paul stared at his father, unable to speak for a moment. Then,
"A Mentat? Me? But I..." "How it agrees, son. It's true.
But I thought Mentat training had to start during infancy, and the subject couldn't be told because it might inhibit the early..." He broke off, all his past circumstances coming to focus in one flashing computation. "I see," he said.
"A day comes," the Duke said, "when the potential Mentat must learn what's being done. It may no longer be done to him. The Mentat has to share in the choice of whether to continue or abandon the training. Some can continue, some are incapable of it. Only the potential Mentat can tell this for sure about himself." Paul rubbed his chin.
All the special training from Hawat and his mother, the mnemonics, the focusing of awareness, the muscle control and sharpening of sensitivities, the study of languages and nuances of voices, all of it clicked into a new kind of understanding in his mind.
"You'll be the Duke some day, son," his father said. "A Mentat Duke would be formidable indeed. Can you decide now, or do you need more time?"
There was no hesitation in his answer. "I'll go on with the training."
"Formidable indeed," the Duke murmured, and Paul saw the proud smile on his father's face. The smile shocked Paul. It had a skull look on the Duke's narrow features. Paul closed his eyes, feeling the terrible purpose reawaken within him.
"Perhaps being a Mentat is terrible purpose," he thought.
But even as he focused on this thought, his new awareness denied it.
With the Lady Jessica and Arrakis, the Bene Gesserit system of sowing implant legends through the Missionaria Protectiva came to its full fruition. The wisdom of seeding the known universe with a prophecy pattern for the protection of the Bene Gesserit personnel has long been appreciated, but never have we seen a condition ut extremis with more ideal mating of person and preparation. The prophetic legends had taken on Arrakis even to the extent of adopted labels, including Reverend Mother, Canto and Respondu, and most of the Sharia Panoplia Propheticus. And it is generally accepted now that the Lady Jessica's latent abilities were grossly underestimated. From Analysis, The Arakene Crisis, by the Princess Irulan. Private Circulation, Bene Gesserit File Number AR8108587.
All around the Lady Jessica, piled in corners of the Arakene Great Hall, mounded in the open spaces, stood the packaged freight of their lives. Boxes, trunks, cartons, cases, some partly unpacked. She could hear the cargo handlers from the guild shuttle depositing another load in the entry. Jessica stood in the center of the hall. She moved in a slow turn, looking up and around at shadowed carvings, crannies, and deeply recessed windows. This giant anachronism of a room reminded her of the sisters' hall at her Bene Gesserit school. But at the school the effect had been of warmth. Here, all was bleak stone. Some architect had reached far back into history for these buttressed walls and dark hangings, she thought. The arched ceiling stood two stories above her, with great cross-beams she felt sure had been shipped here to Arrakis across space at monstrous cost. No planet of this system grew trees to make such beams, unless the beams were imitation wood. She thought not. This had been the government mansion in the days of the old empire. Costs had been of less importance then. It had been before the Harkonnens and their new megalopolis of Carthag, a cheap and brassy place some 200 kilometers northeast across the broken land. Leto had been wise to choose this place for his seat of government. The name Arakene had a good sound, filled with tradition. And this was a smaller city, easier to sterilize and defend. Again there came the clatter of boxes being unloaded in the entry. Jessica sighed. Against the carton to her right stood the painting of the Duke's father. Wrapping twine hung from it like a frayed decoration. A piece of the twine was still clutched in Jessica's left hand. Beside the painting lay a black bull's head mounted on a polished board. The head was a dark island in a sea of wadded paper. Its plaque lay flat on the floor, and the bull's shiny muzzle pointed at the ceiling as though the beast were ready to bellow a challenge into this echoing room. Jessica wondered what compulsion had brought her to uncover those two things first, the head and the painting. She knew there was something symbolic in the action. Not since the day when the Duke's buyers had taken her from the school had she felt this frightened and unsure of herself. The head and the picture. They heightened her feelings of confusion. She shuddered, glanced at the slit windows high overhead. It was still early afternoon here, and in these latitudes the sky looked black and cold, so much darker than the warm blue of Caladan. A pang of homesickness throbbed through her. So far away, Caladan.
Here we are.
The voice was Duke Leto's. She whirled, saw him striding from the arched passage to the dining hall. His black working uniform with red armorial hawk crest at the breast looked dusty and rumpled.
I thought you might have lost yourself in this hideous place, he said.
It is a cold house, she said. She looked at his tallness, at the dark skin that made her think of olive groves and golden sun on blue waters. There was wood smoke in the gray of his eyes, but the face was predatory, thin, full of sharp angles and planes. A sudden fear of him tightened her breast. He had become such a savage, driving person since the decision to bow to the Emperor's command. The whole city feels cold, she said.
It's a dirty, dusty little garrison town, he agreed. But we'll change that.
He looked around the hall. These are public rooms for state occasions. I've just glanced at some of the family apartments in the south wing. They're much nicer. He stepped closer, touched her arm, admiring her stateliness. And again he wondered at her unknown ancestry. A renegade house, perhaps? Some black barred royalty? She looked more regal than the Emperor's own blood. Under the pressure of his stare, she turned half away, exposing her profile, and he realized there was no single and precise thing that brought her beauty to focus. The face was oval under a cap of hair the color of polished bronze. Her eyes were set wide, as green and clear as the morning skies of Caladan. The nose was small, the mouth wide and generous. Her figure was good, but scant, tall and with its curves gone to slimness. He remembered that the lay sisters at the school had called her skinny, so his buyers had told him. But that description oversimplified. She had brought a regal beauty back into the Atreides line. He was glad that Paul favored her. "Where's Paul?" he asked. "Someplace around the house, taking his lessons with Yui."
"Probably in the south wing," he said. "I thought I heard Yui's voice, but I couldn't take time to look."
He glanced down at her, hesitating.
"I came here only to hang the key of Caladan Castle in the dining hall."
She caught her breath, stopped the impulse to reach out to him. Hanging the key, there was finality in that action. But this was not the time or place for comforting. "I saw our banner over the house as we came in," she said. He glanced at the painting of his father.
"Where were you going to hang that?"
"Somewhere in here."
"No."
The word rang flat and final, telling her she could use trickery to persuade, but open argument was useless. Still, she had to try, even if the gesture served only to remind herself that she would not trick him. "My lord," she said, "if you'd only..."
"The answer remains no. I indulge you shamefully in most things, not in this. I've just come from the dining hall where there are..."
"My lord, please,
the choice is between your digestion and my ancestral dignity, my dear," he said. "They will hang in the dining hall."
She sighed. "Yes, my lord."
"You may resume your custom of dining in your rooms whenever possible. I shall expect you at your proper position only on formal occasions."
"Thank you, my lord."
"And don't go all cold and formal on me. Be thankful that I never married you, my dear. Then it'd be your duty to join me at table for every meal."
She held her face immobile, nodded.
"Howard already has our own poison snooper over the dining table," he said. "There's a portable in your room."
"You anticipated this disagreement," she said.
"My dear, I think also of your comfort. I've engaged servants. They're locals, but Howard has cleared them. They're Fremen all. They'll do until our own people can be released from their other duties."
"Can anyone from this place be truly safe?"
"Anyone who hates Harkonnens. You may even want to keep the head housekeeper, the Shadout Mapes."
"Shadout," Jessica said. "A Fremen title?"
"I'm told it means well-dipper.
a meaning with rather important overtones here. She may not strike you as a servant type, although Hawat speaks highly of her on the basis of Duncan's report. They're convinced she wants to serve, specifically that she wants to serve you.
Me?
The Fremen have learned that you're Bene Gesserit, he said. There are legends here about the Bene Gesserit.
The Missionaria Protectiva, Jessica thought. No place escapes them.
Does this mean Duncan was successful? She asked. Will the Fremen be our allies? There's nothing definite, he said. They wish to observe us for a while, Duncan believes. They did, however, promise to stop raiding our outlying villages during a truce period. That's a more important gain than it might seem. Hawat tells me the Fremen were a deep thorn in the Harkonnen side, that the extent of their ravages was a carefully guarded secret. It wouldn't have helped for the Emperor to learn the ineffectiveness of the Harkonnen military.
A Fremen housekeeper,
Jessica mused, returning to the subject of the shout-out mapes.
She'll have the all-blue eyes.
Don't let the appearance of these people deceive you, he said. There's a deep strength and healthy vitality in them. I think they'll be everything we need.
It's a dangerous gamble, she said.
Let's not go into that again, he said. She forced a smile.
We are committed, no doubt of that.
She went through the quick regimen of calmness, the two deep breaths, the ritual thought, then...
When I assign rooms, is there anything special I should reserve for you?
You must teach me someday how you do that, he said. The way you thrust your worries aside and turn to practical matters, it must be a Bene Gesserit thing.
It's a female thing, she said.
He smiled. Well, assignment of rooms. Make certain I have large office space next to my sleeping quarters. There'll be more paperwork here than on Caladan. A guard room, of course. That should cover it. Don't worry about security of the house. Howard's men have been over it in depth.
I'm sure they have.
He glanced at his wristwatch. And you might see that all our timepieces are adjusted for Arakeen local. I've assigned a tech to take care of it. He'll be along presently. He brushed a strand of her hair back from her forehead. I must return to the landing field now. The second shuttle's due any minute with my staff reserves.
Couldn't Howard meet them, my lord? You look so tired.
The good Thufir is even busier than I am. You know this planet's infested with Harkonnen intrigues. Besides, I must try persuading some of the trained spice hunters against leaving. They have the option, you know, with the change of fief. And this planetologist, the Emperor and the Landstrat installed as judge of the change, cannot be bought. He's allowing the opt. About 800 trained hands expect to go out on the spice shuttle, and there's a guild cargo ship standing by.
My lord...
She broke off, hesitating.
Yes? He will not be persuaded against trying to make this planet secure for us, she thought, and I cannot use my tricks on him.
At what time will you be expecting dinner? She asked. That's not what she was going to say, he thought. Ah, my Jessica. Would that we were somewhere else. Anywhere away from this terrible place, alone, the two of us. Without a care. I'll eat in the officer's mess at the field, he said. Don't expect me until very late, and, I'll be sending a guard car for Paul. I want him to attend our strategy conference. He cleared his throat as though to say something else, then, without warning, turned and strode out, headed for the entry where she could hear more boxes being deposited. His voice sounded once from there, commanding and disdainful, the way he always spoke to servants when he was in a hurry. The Lady Jessica's in the Great Hall. Join her there immediately. The outer door slammed. Jessica turned away, faced the painting of Leto's father. It had been done by the famed artist, Albi, during the old Duke's middle years. He was portrayed in matador costume with a magenta cape flung over his left arm. The face looked young, hardly older than Leto's now, and with the same hawk features, the same gray stare. She clenched her fists at her sides, glared at the painting.
Damn you! Damn you! Damn you! She whispered.
What are your orders, noble-born?
It was a woman's voice, thin and stringy.
Jessica whirled, stared down at a knobby, gray-haired woman in a shapeless sack dress of bondsman brown. The woman looked as wrinkled and desiccated as any member of the mob that had greeted them along the way from the landing field that morning. Every native she had seen on this planet, Jessica thought, looked prune dry and undernourished. Yet Leto had said they were strong and vital. And there were the eyes, of course, that wash of deepest, darkest blue, without any white. Secretive, mysterious. Jessica forced herself not to stare. The woman gave a stiff-necked nod, said,
"I am called the Shadout Mapes, noble-born. What are your orders?"
"You may refer to me as my lady," Jessica said. "I'm not noble-born. I'm the bound concubine of the Duke Leto." Again that strange nod, and the woman peered upward at Jessica with a sly questioning.
"There's a wife, then?"
"There is not, nor has there ever been. I am the Duke's only companion, the mother of his heir designate." Even as she spoke, Jessica laughed inwardly at the pride behind her words. "What was it St. Augustine said?" she asked herself. "The mind commands the body and it obeys. The mind orders itself and meets resistance. Yes, I am meeting more resistance lately. I could use a quiet retreat by myself." A weird cry sounded from the road outside the house. It was repeated. "Su-su-suk! Su-su-suk!" Then, "Ikute! Ikute!" And again, "Su-su-suk!" "What is that?" Jessica asked. "I heard it several times as we drove through the streets this morning."
"Only a water cellar, my lady. But you've no need to interest yourself in such as they. The cistern here holds 50,000 liters, and it's always kept full."
She glanced down at her dress.
"Why, you know, my lady, I don't even have to wear my still suit here," she cackled. "And me not even dead?"
Jessica hesitated, wanting to question this Fremen woman, needing data to guide her. But bringing order of the confusion in the castle was more imperative. Still, she found the thought unsettling that water was a major mark of wealth here. "My husband told me of your title, Shadout," Jessica said. "I recognized the word. It's a very ancient word."
"You know the ancient tongues, then?" Mapes asked,
and she waited with an odd intensity. "Tongues are the Bene Gesserit's first learning," Jessica said. "I know the Botanijib, in the Chakobsa, all the hunting languages." Mapes nodded.
"Just as the legend says."
And Jessica wondered, "Why do I play out this sham?" But the Bene Gesserit ways were devious and compelling. "I know the dark things and the ways of the Great Mother," Jessica said. She read the more obvious signs in Mapes' actions and appearance, the petty betrayals.
"Missa sis presia," she said in the Chakobsa tongue. "Andra altere pera, trada sic buscacri miseces pracri."
Mapes took a backward step, appeared poised to flee. "I know many things," Jessica said. "I know that you have borne children, that you have lost loved ones, that you have hidden in fear, and that you have done violence and will yet do more violence. I know many things." In a low voice, Mapes said,
"I meant no offense, my lady."
"You speak of the legend and seek answers," Jessica said. "Beware the answers you may find. I know you came prepared for violence with a weapon in your bodice."
"My lady, I..."
"There's a remote possibility you could draw my life's blood," Jessica said. "But in so doing, you'd bring down more ruin than your wildest fears could imagine. There are worse things than dying, you know, even for an entire people."
"My lady," Mapes pleaded.
She appeared about to fall to her knees.
"The weapon was sent as a gift to you, should you prove to be the one."
"And as the means of my death, should I prove otherwise?" Jessica said. She waited in the seeming relaxation that made the Bene Gesserit trained so terrifying in combat. "Now we see which way the decision tips," she thought. Slowly, Mapes reached into the neck of her dress, brought out a dark sheath. A black handle with deep finger ridges protruded from it. She took sheath in one hand and handle in the other, withdrew a milk-white blade, held it up. The blade seemed to shine and glitter with a light of its own. It was double-edged, like a kinjal, and the blade was perhaps 20 centimeters long.
"Do you know this, my lady?"
Mapes asked. It could only be one thing, Jessica knew. The fabled Kriss knife of Arrakis. The blade that had never been taken off the planet and was known only by rumor and wild gossip. "It's a Kriss knife," she said.
"Say it not lightly," Mapes said. "Do you know its meaning?"
And Jessica thought. There was an edge to that question. Here's the reason this Fremen had taken service with me, to ask that one question. My answer could precipitate violence or what? She seeks an answer from me, the meaning of a knife. She's called the Shadout in the Chakopsa tongue. Knife, that's Deathmaker in Chakopsa. She's getting restive. I must answer now. Delay is as dangerous as the wrong answer. Jessica said, "It's a maker." "Hey!" Mapes wailed. It was a sound of both grief and elation. She trembled so hard the knife blade sent glittering shards of reflection shooting around the room. Jessica waited, poised. She had intended to say the knife was a maker of death, and then add the ancient word, but every sense warned her now, all the deep training of alertness that exposed meaning in the most casual muscle twitch. The key word was maker. Maker? Maker. Still Mapes held the knife as though ready to use it. Jessica said, "Did you think that I, knowing the mysteries of the Great Mother, would not know the Maker?" Mapes lowered the knife.
"My lady, when one has lived with prophecy for so long, the moment of revelation is a shock."
Jessica thought about the prophecy, the Sharia, and all the Panoplia Propheticus, a Bene Gesserit of the Missionaria Protectiva dropped here long centuries ago. Long dead, no doubt, but her purpose accomplished. The protective legends implanted in these people against the day of a Bene Gesserit's need. Well, that day had come. Mapes returned knife to sheath, said,
"This is an unfixed blade, my lady. Keep it near you. More than a week away from flesh and it begins to disintegrate. It's yours, a tooth of Shai-Hulud, for as long as you live."
Jessica reached out her right hand, risked a gamble. "Mapes, you've sheathed that blade unblooded." With a gasp, Mapes dropped the sheathed knife into Jessica's hand, tore open the brown bodice, wailing,
"Take the water of my life!"
Jessica withdrew the blade from its sheath. How it glittered! She directed the point toward Mapes, saw a fear greater than death panic come over the woman. "Poison in the point?" Jessica wondered. She tipped up the point, drew a delicate scratch with the blade's edge above Mapes' left breast. There was a thick welling of blood that stopped almost immediately. Ultra-fast coagulation, Jessica thought. A moisture-conserving mutation? She sheathed the blade, said, "Button your dress, Mapes." Mapes obeyed, trembling. The eyes, without whites, stared at Jessica.
"You are ours," she muttered. "You are the one."
There came another sound of unloading in the entry. Swiftly, Mapes grabbed the sheathed knife, concealed it in Jessica's bodice.
"Who sees that knife must be cleansed or slain," she snarled. "You know that, my lady."
"I know it now," Jessica thought. The cargo handlers left without intruding on the great hall. Mapes composed herself, said,
"The uncleansed who have seen a Kriss knife may not leave Arrakis alive. Never forget that, my lady. You've been entrusted with a Kriss knife."
She took a deep breath.
"Now the thing must take its course. It cannot be hurried."
She glanced at the stacked boxes and piled goods around them.
and there's work aplenty to while the time for us here.
Jessica hesitated. The thing must take its course. That was a specific catchphrase from the Missionaria Protectiva's stock of incantations. The coming of the Reverend Mother to free you. But I'm not a Reverend Mother, Jessica thought, and then, Great Mother, they planted that one here. This must be a hideous place. In matter-of-fact tones, Mapes said,
What'll you be wanting me to do first, my lady?
Instinct warned Jessica to match that casual tone. She said, The painting of the old Duke over there, it must be hung on one side of the dining hall. The bull's head must go on the wall opposite the painting. Mapes crossed to the bull's head.
What a great beast it must have been to carry such a head, she said.
She stooped.
I'll have to be cleaning this first, won't I, my lady? No. But there's dirt caked on its horns.
That's not dirt, Mapes. That's the blood of our Duke's father. Those horns were sprayed with a transparent fixative within hours after this beast killed the old Duke. Mapes stood up.
Ah, now, she said.
It's just blood, Jessica said. Old blood at that. Get some help hanging these now. The beastly things are heavy.
Did you think the blood bothered me? Mapes asked. I'm of the desert, and I've seen blood aplenty.
I see that you have, Jessica said.
And some of it my own, Mapes said. More'n you drew with your puny scratch.
You'd rather I'd cut deeper?
Ah, no, the body's water is scant enough, thou'rt gushing a wasteful lot of it into the air. You did the thing right.
And Jessica, noting the words and manner, caught the deeper implications in the phrase, the body's water. Again she felt a sense of oppression at the importance of water on Arrakis.
On which side of the dining hall shall I hang which one of these prettiest, my lady?
Mapes asked. Ever the practical one, this Mapes, Jessica thought. She said, Use your own judgment, Mapes. It makes no real difference.
As you say, my lady.
Mapes stooped, began clearing wrappings and twine from the head.
Killed an old duke, did you?
She crooned. Shall I summon a handler to help you? Jessica asked.
I'll manage, my lady.
Yes, she'll manage, Jessica thought. There's that about this Fremen creature, the drive to manage. Jessica felt the cold sheath of the kris-knife beneath her bodice, thought of the long chain of Bene Gesserit's scheming that had forged another link here. Because of that scheming, she had survived a deadly crisis.
It cannot be hurried, Mapes had said.
Yet there was a tempo of headlong rushing to this place that filled Jessica with foreboding. And not all the preparations of the Missionaria Protectiva, nor Howard's suspicious inspection of this castellated pile of rocks, could dispel the feeling. When you've finished hanging those, start unpacking the boxes, Jessica said. One of the cargo men at the entry has all the keys and knows where things should go. Get the keys and the list from him. If there are any questions, I'll be in the south wing.
As you will, my lady,
Mapes said. Jessica turned away, thinking, How it may have passed this residency as safe, but there's something wrong about the place. I can feel it. An urgent need to see her son gripped Jessica. She began walking toward the arched doorway that led into the passage to the dining hall and the family wings. Faster and faster she walked until she was almost running. Behind her, Mapes paused in clearing the wrappings from the bull's head, looked at the retreating back.
She's the one, all right,
she muttered.
Poor thing.